The following presentation was recorded at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Oh, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You know, that's good to get the audience responding. Good afternoon. All right. I'll try to stay awake if you'll try to stay awake. Well, if I keep speaking loud enough, we can keep that ventilation on. And if I start getting quiet or too fast, you know, just like Brandon, okay, answer, slow me down. Because I get excited about it, and I start rambling on and on and on. Everybody goes, what did he say? But anyway, you know, in the Bible it says, be long on hearing, be short on speaking, and short on anger. And I guess I blew that because when Melvin called me, and I had not met him, he called me on the phone, and he said, what about doing a presentation like this? I think before he asked me, I already in my inside was going, yes, all right, fantastic. And then afterwards, I was like, oh, Lord, what did I do? You know, I've got to, it seemed like a lot of time back then. But it's amazing how you procrastinate. You don't start paying attention to it till the date's starting to come. It becomes real. But I appreciate being here today. I bring this in an area. I brought it in as algebraic expressions. There'll be some thought processes we'll go through and thinking through light travel and time differences. As I say, I brought it out in algebraic. There'll be vectors, if you know vectors, if you know differential equations. I'm not going to work in that area. I'm trying to keep it simple so I can understand it and explain it. And one of the brothers, I think it was Dwayne or might have been Alvin, said it today, you know, you understand it when you understand it. And then when you understand it, you can tell other people about it. So that's what I was really struggling with. As Melvin already said, I had work. Well, my wife and I had worked for 7 years, Nancy over there, at Fermi National Accelerator Lab when it just started, back in the early 70s. And we were working in particle physics and relativistic theory and identifying the unending seams particles that they find. And at that point in time, it wasn't smashing them together. It was accelerating them, passing them through a magnet that you knew the strength of. And then we were building proportional chambers, basically with X and a Y axes that would get excited when a particle passed through there. And you could tell where that particle was, and you knew the magnetic strain of the field, so you knew the mass of the particle, and then you just gave it a name. I mean, basically, that's the way they identified them. Now, because they're running out of things to do, and they need higher and higher energies, they're smashing them together. But that was exciting work. And right, that's one of the ways to get to higher energies, just hitting them together. But so it's a whole different realm over at the particle accelerators now than it was when we worked over there. Then I decided, well, you know, we need to make some real money here. We're going to have a family. Go out and... did you shut off the fan? Okay. Okay. Make some money, so I decided to go out in industry, and I did. One of the things that I had done, too, I forgot to mention, back when Nance and I were working our way through school, we needed to eat, so one of the things we got was a lab job, lab assistant. And we happened to be working in 68-69 time frame in DNA mapping. And I think it was, 62-64 that Watson Crick came up with their formula, or the DNA structure. So we had the opportunity of working back then and trying to get into some mapping, things that were fascinating then, or even more so now because of the way they get applied. Give you a little background. Both Nance and I, just a little testimony, grew up Catholic. And when Dwayne talked about the students in the Catholic school and talked about purgatory, I was one of the children in that classroom. Not necessarily that one, but... didn't read the Bible. You know, you were taught the doctrine of the Catholic Church, and that's where you grew up. And we spent a lot of our life. Matter of fact, it's only been about 5 years ago that I was saved, and a little before that I found the Word and the power that's in the Word. Praise God. And in that journey, one of the reasons that I got into science was because I was fascinated with the world and what God had created. And science was a way to look at it and to try to understand God. And it was interesting because in the life that we went through in business, I didn't think much about, and in the industry, my salvation, about God, you know, and we got into the humanistic side and heard all the other arguments. And Nance got invited to a Bible study, which she went to, and I mocked her the whole time she was going there. But she went, she was faithful in going, and she was saved after, I guess, a couple of years of going to that, and yet nobody in our family was. And then what I started doing, though, the Lord was moving on my life. He was saying, you got to learn more about me. So I started reading books on astrophysics, and a brother and I over lunch were talking. Is it Marty or Patrick? I was close. I'm terrible with names. But anyway, we were talking over lunch with Patrick and talking about astrophysics, and he has a desire for that. And I started reading all these astrophysics books to get a feeling for, boy, God is magnificent out there and all the things that are out there. And I had the author that was writing it at the time was a Christian, and he had a series of books, and it was just fascinating. Well, then somewhere along the line, Nance found a book called Genesis of the Big Bang, which is written by a Jewish astrophysicist. And the thing that, I see the fallacies in this book now, but the thing that was key in this book is that he had a lot of scripture. And he developed the development of his book on scripture, starting at Genesis, and then using relativity and quantum mechanics to explain how this all could have taken place in 7 days. Well, I don't think I got a third of the way, a quarter of the way through that book, and every time I ran into the scripture, what I'd do is I'd open up the Bible. And you're discerning, right? And you want to make sure he quotes it right. So I pull out the Bible, and before I knew it, I was reading the Bible. I threw away the book, put it on the side, and I started reading it from Genesis right through. And along the way, I just, you know, it was like I was out of town in a hotel, and I said to the Lord, I said, you know, where do we go from here? You know, praying and asking for forgiveness of sins and asking for direction. And I was filled with a presence that scared me at first. And I didn't know about the born-again experience at the time and about the Holy Spirit. But I realize now what happened at that time. And when I came home, I happened to be out in California at the time, my family saw the difference in me. One of the things the Lord did was get me to go back to church because I kept saying there's too many hypocrites. Don't want to bother with a church. Forget the Catholic Church. I know there's something wrong with it. Now I know what it is. And we had just gone, I guess, for about a week and a half. Made the commitment to bring the family and go over to Floyd Miller's church in North Liberty, Indiana. And the Lord did the rest. Fantastic. But anyway, so I come from studying science, not knowing the Bible. And when I found the Bible, I was fascinated about how scientific the Bible is. And Isaac Asimov, you may or may not be familiar with him. You may have read some of his works, but he's Jewish, and he's also an atheist, and he's dead, so he knows the answers now. But he and other people have written about history of mankind, and they have said that if you look at the development of science, it parallels Judeo-Christian society, because the Bible makes you think. And Brother Dwayne was up here today talking about that. The Bible does make you think. And I was just so fascinated to find so many different scriptures that talk about scientific things in the Bible. Now, see, I just wanted to go through some scripture. One of the things at lunchtime we talked about, Stephen Hawkins, and how Stephen Hawkins was a Christian. He was married for a number of years to a young woman, and they lived together before he had Lou Gehrig's disease. And then he published, and I think the ego got to him. And he's since divorced. If you've read his book, you know that he's not a Christian any longer per his books. And how an individual can get so wrapped up in themselves, you know, and how insignificant we are, but yet we put ourselves on a pedestal. And Hawkins is an example of that. I've heard that of recent, though. I don't know if anybody has an update, that in the last year or so that he's starting to go back to church. I'm not sure what kind of church, but they related it to him coming back to his Christianity. And I thought of 2 Timothy starting in chapter 4, verse 1, where it says, I charge you therefore before God and the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall judge the quick and the dead at his appearance in his kingdom. Preach the word and be instant, in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but after their own lusts they will heap to themselves teachers having itching ears. And I looked up itching ears in the Strong's and comes up restless. And they will turn away their ears from the truth and shall be turned to fables. But watch thou in all things, endure afflictions, do the work of an evangelist, make full proof of thy ministry. And that's where, and it was mentioned earlier today, you know, stay with the word. As you're teaching, make sure you go back to the word. Don't forget the Bible, because you can easily, as Hawkins and others have, get too involved with yourself and forget about God. Let Satan lead you astray. And also, I wanted to turn to... Is that just...
Okay.
Didn't know if we had the scamper out of here or not. Psalm 19, verse 1. I'll just read just a few of them in here. It talks about, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showed his handiwork. And these were really quite an impact on me when I started reading the Bible and seeing these things in the Bible. And then in Ecclesiastes, chapter 3, verse 11, he had made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he had set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. And in the commentary here, it talks about that God has given man an eternal perspective so that he can look beyond the routine of life. Nevertheless, he has not revealed all his life's mysteries to man. And those are the things I'm sure we're going to learn about when we go to heaven. And then in Romans 1, verse 20 through... starting at verse 20, it talks about, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so they are without excuse. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, became vain in their imagination, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And change the glory of the uncorruptible God into the image make like to corruptible man and to birds and four-footed beasts and creepy things. And again, I think people like Hawkins, Carl Sagan, others, you know, that aren't as well known, you know, and even myself. I mean, you can get into that where if you're not focusing on the word, if you don't know the word, you're not focusing on it, you can easily get led astray, and Satan can work on you and say, boy, isn't man great? Okay. Now, I know how Tim felt, and I know how some of the others. It's been a great day. I wish I was here yesterday. Could have heard Milo. But I really learned a lot today. I really enjoyed the conferences that were here and the demonstrations. I wish I had a few demonstrations to bring with, but... unless we can get in a spaceship and go someplace, there's not much I can do. Tim had a heavy topic to talk on. There's a lot to cover in a short time. And if I can get on with it now, hopefully we can cover a lot of material. And I don't completely swamp you and swamp myself on this. But what I want to talk about and what I've been asked to speak on is relativity. And relativity, let me know if these charts don't come up high enough. But basically, the objective of this presentation is a brief overview of the principles of relativity. And I call them principles because something's a theory until it's proven, and there's a lot of experiments that take place and change it from a theory. They initially start with a hypothesis. Once you do all your work and you can't disprove it, then you start taking it on the technical side. You start running experiments that try to prove what happens. You validate the mathematics. And then you can move it up to the realm of a principle. Well, Newton's been a principle for a long time of relativity. And I don't know how recent, it's been in probably the last decade, that Einstein's theories have been brought up to be principles rather than theories. But relativity would be presented in terms of the familiar sensory inputs of the space-time Newtonian world that we're living in, that we're more experienced with and most familiar. And relativity is not destructive of the classical Newtonian dynamics. It's a natural outgrowth as man endeavors to understand God's wondrous creation and begins to deal with velocities approaching the speed of light. And God is letting us. He's opening up our eyes so that we can see these things. For what reason? I don't know. It's been dramatic. You're all aware of the dramatic increase in technology just in the last 100 years, or 50 years, for that. The topics I want to go into today would be inertial versus non-inertial reference frames, sound wave propagation, and I want to go into sound wave because sounds, one way to introduce the concept that we're going to get into in light in a familiar environment for us. Then the uniqueness of light. Something that was key was a Michelson-Morley experiment that I'll show you. I have a graph of that and talk a bit about it. The nature of time. The effects on distant measurements with speeds approaching light, and the effects on mass with speeds approaching that of light, and then just, you know, faster than light. And we're going to talk about special relativity today because we're going to be talking about inertial reference frames. We're not going to get into general relativity. General relativity gets into the concepts of gravity, acceleration, and that'd be just too much to get into. Okay, what is an inertial reference frame? Are you comfortable with that? Do you understand the term inertial reference frame? Is it anybody here who's never heard it before? Oh, good grief. Okay, an inertial reference frame. It's a system that's not accelerating, not rotating, because if you have a rotary motion, you have acceleration. You either have gravity or you have some acceleration that's coming inward to the center of that motion. So it would be a spaceship moving through space in a straight line at a constant velocity. A non-inertial reference frame would be the reference frame we live in right now. We're in a non-inertial reference frame because we're experiencing gravity. The spaceship that's out in space is in a non-inertial reference frame in the mirror because they are held there going around in a circle by gravity, so they're undergoing acceleration. If they were to let loose and just travel in a straight line at a constant velocity, then they'd be in an inertial reference frame. And it's an important distinction because whether it's Newtonian or whether it's Einsteinian relativity, inertial reference frames, no matter... If you're measuring something and you're in an inertial reference frame, the results are always going to be the same for you in that frame. When you look at someone else, the results will look different if you can see somebody else traveling a different frame. But in your frame, they'll be the same. And a quick example of that would be if you're in an airplane and you're talking, you're pouring water, the plane's just moving along smoothly, you're walking, you really wouldn't know the difference than if you were sitting here in this room. And even in this room, we don't have a concept of the speeds we're traveling at because we don't see the world outside of us. So if you close off that outside world and you do the measurements, they'll be the same for you, irrespective of the velocity that you're moving at. We're going to deal with that as we go through here. So, for instance, if you look at the motion of an inertial object in a reference frame, again, traveling at a constant velocity, the graph here, what you see is the vertical here is time, the horizontal is distance. And what you have is you have an object that's traveling along here at 100 miles an hour, and you have an object that's traveling along at 25 miles an hour here. And the way you figure distance is you take velocity times time, and you get your distance. So if you want to take this graph and you want to see where this person is, you can either plot it out on the graph or use the formula and say, okay, at 25 miles an hour, at 4 hours, I'll travel 100 miles. And you can predict where that person will be or that object. Same here. This one's traveling at 100 miles an hour. So if you plug in 100 miles an hour for the velocity, 2 hours for the time, you can predict where that, how far away from its initial point it'll be. It'll be 200 miles. And you can see here the slope of the line is dependent upon the speed. The steeper the slope, the slower it is. The less the slope, the faster the object's moving. Now, if you look at a non-inertial reference frame, you get into acceleration. And if you look at acceleration, not going into differential calculus, but you look at it in general, it's basically the velocity initially of an initial time and the velocity after some span of time. And then you pick that span of time, Ti and Tf. So, for instance, if you take this object here, the dotted line, to be moving at 100 miles an hour, its initial velocity down here was zero. Zero was the hours, but you want to see what happened after 2 hours, plugging in the numbers to the first equation. You find out the acceleration over that 2 hour time, over that span of time, was 50 miles per hour per hour. Then the distance, you can calculate then the distance that was traveled. The distance would be equal to that velocity initial times the time span you're looking at, plus one half the acceleration, which we calculated, times the time span squared. So then if you plug in the values, the initial velocity is zero times 2 hours, and then it would be one plus one half 50 miles per hour, which is the acceleration, times 2 hours squared. You come up with one half times 50 miles per hour times 4 hours squared, and you would come up with 100 miles. So it's a more complex equation. That's why I don't want to get into general relativity. We just don't have the time. But then you could predict. After 2 hours, we know what the rate of change in velocity was over those 2 hours. We know they traveled 100 miles. And what you see on this curve is that it's a curve here. As it curves and changes, what you're seeing is acceleration. In this case, it would be deceleration because you're covering less distance in a big span of time. Then it accelerates here because you're covering a greater distance in the short span of time than decelerating and accelerating. I just wanted to go into sound wave propagation just briefly. Hang on, I got these out of order. It's always nice to think that you got all your slides in order and then find out that you've got them on, not in order. Oh well. If we can go with this one. Okay, hopefully they're not too out of order. Anyway. There's always a fly in the ointment, isn't there? Okay, sound wave. Basically, sound travels and requires a medium, some kind of ether. In this case, it's air. We had the experiment earlier today where the gentleman took the coat hanger, and then you couldn't hear anything, and then he put it on his ear. Well, he used the string as a medium to propagate that sound. Then sound consists basically of compression, a variation in wave. And if you look at the variation in the length of the wave, and if you look at sound at atmospheric pressure and a standard temperature, it travels about 450 or 750 miles an hour. Now, the wavelength, the sound, the pitch that we hear depends upon that wavelength of the sound or how frequently it's compressed together. Now, one of the things that you're all familiar with is Doppler effect. And one of the things we can do is I'll go through an equation and I'll show it on light also. Doppler effect allows one to calculate with the formula that Doppler developed, allows you to calculate the effective change in frequency, which is the pitch that we hear, due to the relative motion of the source and the receiver. Now, one of the things that some people don't appreciate, and I forgot about that, is that the Doppler shift, when the source is moving relative to the air and the receiver stationary, is different than the Doppler shift if the receiver is moving and the source is stationary. So if you're standing on a railroad track, and that was the pictures that I had here, and don't be standing on the railroad track, but if you're standing and you've got a moving... they are backwards. Ugh. You've got a stationary observer and a moving source. So you're sitting by a railroad track and you hear a train coming. That pitch, you know, you hear the engine, you hear the pitch, the whistle, it'll be high. It'll come past you and it'll drop. And if you, and after, and also, if you're, when it passes you, it drops. And this is the formula for that. Basically, what the formula says is that the frequency change that you'll hear after it passes you will be equal to the initial frequency that the whistle's actually blowing at, divided or times the sound's velocity, how fast that object is traveling, or the speed of sound, 750 miles per hour, divided by the speed of the sound, the velocity of the sound, plus or minus the velocity of the source. And the reason it's plus or minus the velocity of source, it's because it depends upon whether the source is moving to you or away from you. So you use the change in sign to show that. And what I did is I thank God there's computers now, and I put a graph together here. And the ones, I put a number of different frequencies in hertz, number of different velocities of the source, and if you look here, some are plus, some are minus. And the minus sign means that the source is moving to the observer. The plus sign means it's moving away from the observer. And then I've got the velocity of sound fixed at 750 miles an hour, then the frequency of sound heard by the observer, and then the change in that frequency. And if you look just at these first two, at 200 hertz, if the train's moving away from the observer, what you find out is that the frequency changes from 200 to 133 hertz with a minus or a change, a decrease of 33%. If you look at the train coming to the observer, the 200 hertz becomes 400 hertz, you get a 100% increase. Now the other one...
A question on that before...
Yes.
If I may.
Surely.
So if the train is moving at standing set track, you're shifting from a positive, say, from a negative 375 miles per hour to a positive 375 miles an hour. So you're going to hear a 400 to 133
shift in the frequency of that sound, whatever it happens to be. And you know that from when cars go by or trains go by. Exactly. Yes. In the other situation, if you've got a stationary, stationary source and a moving observer. So the other first case, we had a stationary observer and a moving source. In this case, we have a stationary source and a moving observer. So you can say you're in a car moving, and there's somewhere it's emitting some sound that's stationary. So you're either moving to it or away from it. So then the frequency, and the formula is different here, as you can see, the frequency that you're going to hear due to the change, Doppler effect, is equal to the frequency that's being transmitted times the velocity of sound plus or minus, there should be a minus sign in here, plus or minus the velocity of the observer, and that depends whether you're moving to it or away from it, divided by the velocity of the observer. So again, looking at a chart, if you see it. Here is, you've got a 200 hertz sound, velocity observer. In this case, the plus sign means that the observer is moving to the source, and the minus sign means that the observer is moving from the source. The velocity observer is 375 miles an hour. The velocity of sound, 750. The frequency of sound heard by the observer in this case would be 300, a 50% increase. We saw 100 just a while ago. And going the other way, going at away from the source at 375 miles an hour, the frequency heard would be 100, which would be a 50% decrease. Oh, what goes into the difference in the when you develop the equations? If I can get them both on here. And again, there's a plus or minus sign in here. It goes into the, when you derive the formulas for it, it goes into the difference in the equations that you come up with. And you could also show it on a graph. I don't want to spend too much time on it. But if you think of a unit of measure, and you think about a sound wave coming out, and that sound wave is going to be coming out, and the source, the receiver is going to be moving to it. The receiver is going to be moving half the speed of that sound wave. Well, in that unit of measurement, the receiver will only travel a third as far as the sound source. So there'll be a ratio. We'll get more into this later. But it goes back to the derivation of the sound. And I don't want to spend too much time on this. We could talk about it later, because you could draw it out as a unit measurement and show why it's different when it's the observer moving versus the source that's moving. There's also a different equation when you start talking about the source moving and the observer moving. And the equation looks like this. You've got a situation where you've got the final frequency is equal to the frequency times the velocity of the sound plus or minus the velocity of the observer over the velocity of sound minus or plus the velocity of the source. And the way these work is the plus and the minus work together, and the minus and the plus, depending on the relative motion. I've got a graph here that gets into that. Okay, looks like we might be back in the right order. So if you look at this graph here, what you see is that plus minus in the equation that's down here, plus on top, minus on the bottom, denotes observer and source moving together. The minus plus denotes observer and source moving apart. So in this case, you got a situation where they're coming together and you're going from 200 to 600 with a 200% increase. And here you've got a case where they're moving apart differently, and you're going to a minus 67 percent difference, or 67 hertz frequency. I'm afraid this is going to throw too much confusion into it. I shouldn't put that part in. But there's a difference. That's what's important, that there's a difference. And if you look at these equations and you go through it and take the time to look at them, you'll see some are 0% increases, because basically what you're doing is you're doing, you're moving together in the same directions, either to the right or to the left from each other. And if we had the time that we would need to go through this, you could see the differences in the motions and the differences that you see in the observers and the receiver both moving versus one being stationary. Well, the one that I wanted to get back to is this one here, where it shows the moving observer and the moving source. And for instance, here you've got the observer moving, here you've got the source moving, just looking at 200 hertz, and you've got it moving away and together. And you see that the differences are plus or minus 50% in the case where the source is moving, and you've got 100% here, and a minus 33% in the case of the receiver moving. So you can see that. You'd think they'd be the same, but in reality, they're not the same. Now what I want to start going into is light propagation and start relating this to light, which is what the specific thing that we want to cover here today. Okay, the uniqueness of light. Newtonian principle of relativity, all inertial observers are dynamically equivalent. Measurements in each inertial reference frame produce equivalent results. So that means, again, if you're in that airplane moving along and you want to measure the speed of sound or you want to measure the motion of something, you'll do those measurements in the airplane. You'll come up with the same results than you as you would when you're down here on Earth. The other thing is that when Maxwell had shown that light was actually a wave, and this goes back to the 1800s, that light was a wave, people right away assumed, since sound waves, earthquakes, ocean waves all travel in a medium, they assumed that light also required some type of medium. And it was for a lot of years that people were looking for this medium. And they said, okay, if everything else we know of that's a wave travels in the medium, light requires one. But then how do you explain the fact that light travels from stars to us? You know, we say that space is empty. Well, they said there's some type of medium that it travels in. Well, then the question is, well, do we move with the medium? Is the Earth moving at the speed of the medium? Because if the Earth wasn't moving at the speed of the medium, then there would be, we would observe things differently, which is one of the things Michael Morley showed. If the Earth was moving differently from the speed of the medium, then the light from stars that we see would be, we couldn't depend upon starlight to use it for navigation, because the medium would cause the light as we move through it to be deflected differently. So a star in a certain position as the Earth was moving through this medium would start getting permutated, would start getting moved over, and we couldn't rely on that star being there. The stars would constantly be flickering back and forth. Now, one way to think about that is if you look at say, you've been on a boat on a river, rowing it up and down or have a motor on it, and if you look at the river, and you say the river has a current of 3 miles an hour, and the water being the medium, current coming downstream here at 3 miles an hour, and you look at a ship that has a velocity of 5 miles an hour. Now, you want to cover a distance of 2 miles. You want to go up, and you want to come back down. How long will it take that ship to make that distance? Well, when you go and calculate, you calculate the ship's velocity and the time it would take it for going with the current, you would come up with the velocity total that the ship would be traveling coming with the current would be equal to the velocity of the ship plus the velocity of the current, which would give you 3 plus 5, which would give you 8 miles an hour current. If you look at, okay, now the ship has to return back upstream going against the current, well, the velocity in that case would be a minus 5 miles an hour because of vectors, minus, plus 3 miles an hour, you'd end up with a 2 mile an hour velocity going back upstream. So your difference in speeds would be 8 miles versus 2 miles an hour. Now, you want to compare that against so if you do your calculations then to see how long it would take you to travel that 2 miles up and downstream, what you would come up with is the time travel. The distance would be the time travel would equal the distance divided by the velocity upstream plus the distance divided by the velocity downstream, which would be 2 miles an hour, or 2 miles an hour over 2 miles distance, and then again 2 miles at 8 miles an hour, to give you a total of 1.25 hours to go upstream and downstream to cover that 2 miles. Then, so it's because of the medium, it's because of the movement of the water under you. If you looked at going across 2 miles and coming back, the current coming down, and what you want to do is you want to travel across here. You want to see, now you're moving differently with respect to the medium here. So what you end up doing, and it was mentioned earlier about Pythagorean's theorem and vectors, basically if you're going to go across, you're going to point the ship upstream at an angle against the 3 mile an hour current that's coming, which is the 3 mile down. And if you use Pythagorean's theorem, the velocity is going to equal the velocity squared of the ship minus the velocity squared of the current. So you'll get 5 miles an hour squared for the ship minus 3 miles an hour squared for the current to give you a resultant velocity of 4 miles an hour. So in this case, what you're going to end up seeing, because it's in a medium, and it shows you how a medium affects the motion, you're going to get the velocity upstream and downstream. You're going to get two times it, because they're the same going both directions. You're going to get 2 times 2 miles, 2 miles back and forth, times the velocity, which was calculated before. So you're going to get a travel time of an hour. So if light were truly traveling in a medium that the Earth that was moving with respect to the Earth, then we would expect to see light travel at different speeds if we devised some kind of experiment and rotated it to measure it in different directions relative to the medium. So here we see an hour and a half going up and downstream, an hour and a quarter, and we see 1 hour going across the current. So what happened is Maxwell showed about 100 years ago that light consisted of waves. And it was believed that all light, or everything at that point in time, and that light included, traveled to some kind of medium, like the boat did. And so that means if you did an experiment, you'd always see that light propagates differently. These concepts, people didn't appreciate how radically different they were then. And it's really, you know, if you think 100 years ago, people in dealing with light thoughts, dealing with thoughts on the propagation of light, the world they lived in was all the Newtonian world. They didn't have the experience we have now, people traveling through space, the particle chambers that are out there. They had a totally different concept of the way things worked. And there's two individuals called Michelson-Morley, and in some physics classes, you get involved in actually reproducing this experiment, but people didn't believe it. They didn't believe it was true when it first came out. And what happened is they devised a piece of apparatus that basically had a light source, and they would put it down on a table in one direction, and they would transmit that light. And they would set, everything was fixed. This was a solid tube with mirrors fixed in there. And they would fix it, and then they would look at if there was a difference when they rotated it because of an ether that light was dependent on. Because think about it, if you got it facing this way, and then you go ahead and then you rotate it 90 degrees, and if the ether were moving this way, like the ship, you would expect the light to be affected by it. It would be slowed down somehow. It would be changed or speeded up, depending if you're going with or against the ether. So what they did is they devised this, and the way they could see, they would calibrate it so that there was no interference patterns. And they went ahead and they set it down to 90 degrees, ran the light through there, got no interference patterns. And then what they did is they rotated it 90 degrees. They expected to see a change because the ether would make a change in it. They didn't see a difference. So the conclusion they came to, which is the right one, is that light is unique. It doesn't depend on any type of medium to travel through. We accept that. We know that. It's been proved over and over again, but people couldn't accept it. It was really a simple experiment. So that showed that there was no ether that light traveled through. It made things a lot easier. Now, one of the things Einstein did is he basically took, and he wasn't the only one, there was Lorentz and some others. Einstein just beat him to the punch, like Watson and Crick beat other people to the punch. But Einstein just took the Newtonian theories of relativity, the principle of relativity, and extended it to all physics. And what he said was that all inertial observers are physically equivalent, and no internal experiment can be devised that discriminates in any way between different inertial observers. And again, remember, an inertial observer is someone who's moving at a constant velocity in a straight line. No acceleration, no changes. So he's saying that basically, just as we do for sound and all the other things we're familiar with here on Earth, light's treated the same way. Now, one of the crucial things that Einstein came up with in his discovery of relativity was around dependence on time. Time was considered to be a public entity, no matter where you were. Your clock traveled the same, time progressed the same. And what they find out in relativity is that it's dependent upon you. Your time frames are going to be different depending upon the motion that you're experiencing, what your inertial reference frame's doing. And that's what I want to focus on now. And then the other thing that was staggering, and that takes some thinking about, we're going to go through the formulation on this, is irrespective of your inertial reference frame, when you measure the speed of light, it's going to be 6.7 times 10 to the 8 miles per hour, which is 670 million miles an hour, or 1.86 times 10 to the 5th miles per second. Doesn't matter how you measure that, and we'll go into some calculations that show that to be true. One way to think about route dependence and route independence would be if you and I, say Brandon, we drive from here to New York City. I might get there, and I don't know how far it is, but say I get there and my odometer reads 350 miles. Brandon gets there, his reads 500 miles. Well, that's route independence. We both got to the same place, but we didn't go the same way. He took some side roads, decided to go a different direction than I did. Well, that's true about time, too, in that when you start looking at time in a relativistic frame, to think through them. But basically what I'm taking is time is increasing on the vertical axis for Alfred, who's traveling along in some kind of spaceship in a non-inertial reference frame, constant velocity. And then you've got distance measured across here. Now, Alfred and David are both moving together at the same speeds, and they're not moving away from each other. If they were moving away from each other, you'd have, like Brian here, Brian's moving away. He's at an angle. Brian's moving away from Alfred, but he's moving closer to David. So he's at a different slope. Light on these kind of graphs is shown as a 45-degree angle. So what we're saying here, and I'll have some other pages that come up in a minute. What we're saying here is that Alfred is emitting a light beam, a flash of light, every 6 minutes. David, who's traveling parallel to him at the same velocity, at some distance from him, is going to see those flashes every 6 minutes that Alfred emits. But then we got Brian here, who's traveling faster than David or Alfred. That's why the slope in his line. And we're saying that his time frame, he'll see the flashes that Alfred gives out every 6 minutes. He'll see it in every 9 minutes. And then, if we require that every time Brian sees a flash from Alfred, and he flashes a red light, so that a red light with the white light starts coming from here to Brian, we'll find that even though Brian's flashing it every 9 minutes, those two beams are traveling together, and David will see both of those beams every 6 minutes. I've got some verbiage that goes through it. Oh, I thought that first part was terrible, but this is worse. No. It took a long time to go through this. I mean, just for me to understand it and put it into words. Okay. One of the key things, the first item here, is that it doesn't matter who's moving relative to the velocities. Just the fact that they're moving. So you'll be sitting here, and you'll think somebody else is moving out there, but the reality is we're moving also. But it's the relative speeds between each other that's important. The interval of time of arrival of flashes is that which is measured by the observer's own watch. So Alfred, David, and Brian are using their own watches to measure when those things happen. And then the rates of the interval of reception to interval of transmission are different. So if you look at between Alfred and David, boy, I wish I had two graphs. If you look at between Alfred and David, who are traveling in parallel at the same speed, their interval difference between when they see and when one transmits the light and the other receives the light is one. There's no difference. They're both 6 minutes. If you look at the interval between Alfred and Brian, and that's from 6 minutes to 9 minutes for Brian moving, the ratio of 9 to 6 is 3 to 2. So that's the ratio of difference in time between Alfred and Brian. And then for Brian and David, because they're moving together, it's just a reciprocal relationship, 9 minutes to 6 minutes, again, between Brian and David. So the rates of reception and the interval of transmission, 1 between Alfred and David, 3/2 between Alfred and Brian, and 2/3 between Brian and David. So then what you get is for Alfred and David, and Alfred and David are the two that are moving in parallel together, the observation is the rate at which they see it, 1 times 6, so they both see it at 6, every 6 minutes they see the flashes. For Alfred and Brian, remember Brian's moving away from Alfred, Brian's observation now we're talking about, he sees it as the relationship 3 to 2 times 6 minutes, so he sees the flashes every 9 minutes. And now when you go from Brian, who's moving towards David, Brian will flash a red light every 9 minutes when he sees the white flash from Alfred. Thus, for Brian and David, David's observation now is 2 to 3, the ratio 2 to 3, the reciprocal of the relationship we had here. So it would be 2 to 3 times 9 minutes, every 9 minutes, that's flash from Brian. He'll see it every 6 minutes. Hence, every 6 minutes, David will receive a white and a red flash. And I can give you copies of this, so you look at it. It's not easy. I mean, anyway, it's fascinating. I know when I first went through it, it's like it doesn't make sense, but it works out. And I don't have, I didn't want to go through the equations of it. I thought it would be better to go through the thought process of it. Then, yes.
See, Brian has 9 minutes for every 6 minutes.
You can make that assumption. Right.
Okay. Well, does the difference there, Brian takes many breaths?
Oh, we're going to get into that. Right. Because what it's starting to show is that time is different for Brian than it is for the other two. And I'm glad you asked that. Because this is what we're going to get into now. You thought the other one was bad. This is worse. I'm sorry, Melvin. You didn't know what you were getting into here. But, oh, Lord. What you can think about this one is you've got Alfred. Again, Alfred's moving along, you know, at a constant velocity. So are Brian and Charles. Now, this is a time chart and distance. So what it's saying is that Brian is moving away from Alfred and Charles is moving towards Alfred. Now, the key in this discussion is that Brian and Charles are moving at the same velocities but opposite each other. So you could draw this out on a straight line. And what you could say what you could say is that Alfred, this is Alfred. And think of them moving on a straight line. Alfred's moving along so that this whole frame is moving along. And here comes, who's moving towards him? Here comes Brian. Brian's moving this way. And here comes Charles. Charles is out here somewhere. He's moving this way. So they're both going to pass Alfred on a straight line. They're both going to pass each other somewhere out here in space. So that's one way to look at it. This is another way to look at it. And on here, the key about this chart, and I'm going to go through the verbiage from before, what's going to happen in this case is when Alfred and Brian pass each other, they're going to set their clocks together. They're going to set their watches at noon. So Brian and Alfred would have the same times. Brian's going to continue going out away from him, moving along the straight line, and he's going to flash 10 flashes at 6-minute intervals. And I've got the pages afterwards. What's going to happen, you're going to see that those 10 flashes are received by Alfred at 9-minute intervals. Then what happens when Brian and Charles pass each other, somehow they'll be able to set their watches to the same. And what's going to happen is they're going to be, it's going to be 1 o'clock when they cross their paths. So somewhere out there to the right of Alfred, Brian and Charles are going to pass each other. When they do that, Brian and Charles will both flash their light to Alfred. That beam will travel together. Brian will stop transmitting. Charles will start transmitting. And he'll transmit 10 flashes every 6 minutes. But Alfred will receive those flashes at 4-minute intervals. And when Alfred and Charles meet each other, Alfred's watch is going to be 2:10 and Charles' watch is going to be 2 o'clock. Matter of fact, when Alfred got the last flash here from Brian and the first one from Charles, it was 1:30. Sorry. We can walk through it this way. Maybe, I don't know if this will help. Anyway, Alfred and Brian synchronize watches at 12 when they pass. Brian emits 10 flashes every 6 minutes. Thus, for Alfred and Brian, Alfred's observation, that's the key. The observer's Alfred. The ratio is 3:2. Remember we had that ratio before because it's 6 minutes to 9 minutes, and we can make that assumption because we're creating this scenario. There's nothing wrong with doing that. So it's 3:2. The transmission's every 6 minutes, so Alfred's going to see it every 9 minutes. So the total time lapsed on Alfred's watch is 10 flashes times 9 minutes, which is 90 minutes, or an hour and a half. So while it's only an hour of time for Brian, it's an hour and a half for Alfred. So that gets your question on the times. I guess question of age. He aged 10 minutes longer, or he's 10 minutes older. Then when Charles and Brian synchronize their watches at 1 o'clock, when they pass each other, somewhere out to the left, to the right of Alfred, Charles then starts emitting every 6 minutes. So that first signal Charles sends, the first flash, and the last one that Brian sends go together. They get, so then Alfred then starts transmitting those flashes, and it's a reciprocal relationship because he's moving towards Alfred, so it would be 2/3 times 6 minutes, which says Alfred will get the flashes every 4 minutes. So the total time elapsed on Alfred's watch will be 10 flashes times 4, or it'll be 40 minutes. So, and at the same time, it's an hour for Charles. And then on the last slide, the conclusion then of the time passage for each observer measured on their own watches is that Alfred is equal to 90 minutes with the flashes from Charles and O'Brien, and 40 minutes for the flashes from Brian. So it's a total of 130 minutes or 2 hours and 10 minutes. They started at 12, so it would be 2:10. So Charles and Brian's watches will read 2 o'clock, both of them, because they're traveling at the same velocities. Charles will pass Alfred, and Alfred sees the last flash emitted by Charles. So both Charles and Brian will have the same time, 2 o'clock on their watches. So 2 hours will have passed for Brian and Charles, and you'll have 2 hours and 10 minutes for Alfred. So he will have aged 10 minutes more than the other two. And I can make slides, copies of these slides for anybody that wants to take them. I'd be glad to give it to you. So you can take it, and if you're interested in regurgitating on your own time. Now, one of the things that you see is that what we showed is time slows down as speed increases. And again, I'm not going to throw the equations in here right now, but basically what you have on a chart here, I'm sorry, raise it up a little bit, is you've got time increasing here, And what you have here is, maybe you can't see it, but this is 1/4 C, the speed of light, traveling half the speed of light, traveling 3/4 the speed of light, and traveling at the speed of light. And what you find is that as you increase towards the speed of light, things don't start happening until you get better than 3/4 of the speed of light. Then they really, really happen. And your clock, your time will stretch out. And eventually, what happens to the equation when you reach the speed of light, if that's theoretically possible, if you didn't start out as light, is you turn into light. And time stops. So you think about God. God is light. God is beyond time, right? So time stops for light. There is no time for light. Time doesn't age. Or light doesn't age. Now, we used the graph like this just a while ago, where you've got time and you've got distance on this axis. If you put light going at 45 degrees, that's propagational light. And if you move an object to travel closer to the speed of light, approach the speed of light, what happens is the graph itself changes. So as you increase speed, the t-axis and the x-axis, which is the distance, actually start moving in towards the 45-degree line. And eventually, if you're light, it's on the line. There's no difference. And there's, bring that up because there's a couple of different things to look at. You talk about the simultaneity of things happening. Do things happen to everybody in the same sequence? And apparently it doesn't. Because what happens here is if you've got this observer here on time and across a distance, and he sees events A and B happen, he'll see those events happen at the same time. But if you've got another observer who's moving at relativistic speeds towards the speed of light, what'll happen is again, you take this line, you take parallel coming out, and you'll see that this person here will see event B happen before event A. So one of the things relativity theory comes out with in the equations is that simultaneity of events doesn't make sense. It only makes sense to the observer. So you can think about God, you know, he can go see what's in the past, what's in the future. Okay, I want to look at inertial reference frames, different frames. If you look at, say we're in this frame S, with time and distance, this is time, this is distance. You could just leave it as, this is a Y direction, this is an X direction, two-dimensional space. Then you've got another reference frame. This could be an airplane, something traveling out in space, non-inertial in a straight line, and we're observing this other reference frame. What happens is if you've got a particle, something in this reference frame that's moving, S can tell, it has a velocity relative to this reference frame, and it'll also have a velocity relative to the stationary reference frame that we are. To the person in the reference frame that's moving, the velocity will be V prime. To us standing here, stationary relative to this one, we'll take the velocity of the actual object and add the velocity of the frame. Does that make sense? Okay. And that's the way we naturally do things. So we would come up with, in a Newtonian sense, you're standing on a car. It's going 30 miles an hour down the road. You're a major league pitcher. You could pitch it at 90, 100 miles an hour. So you're standing up there. The car is moving at 30 miles an hour. You pitch the ball at 90. For a short time, that ball is going to go 90 plus 30 or 120 miles an hour. But in relativity, it's not the case. When you start approaching relativistic speeds in these two reference frames, the formula changes. The formula becomes the final velocity for the observer is equal to the velocity of the object, whatever it is moving, plus the velocity of the reference frame, which we had here. But then it's divided by the 1 plus the velocity of the object times the reference frame's velocity divided by light, speed of light squared, c squared. So what that would come up with would be this. V prime would be the measurement in here. U would be the measurement of this frame moving along relative to us. So in taking that formula, if you look at that formula and you say, okay, well then what does it say? Suppose it's light, a light flash that's in that reference frame that's moving. So then the particle itself is moving at the speed of light, and then say the reference frame is moving at the speed of light. Well, you'd expect that the whole thing would be moving in the Newtonian sense twice the speed of light. But when you plug it into the relativity equation, what you come up with is c plus c over 1 plus c times c over c squared, and that becomes 2c over 2, which becomes c. So that's where they get nothing can travel faster than light. So one, light's constant for whatever reference frame you're in, it's always the same speed. And two, if you're sitting here and you're observing, yes?
It's probably too difficult to explain, so how do they come up with the denominator of that equation?
I can
see the numerator, but where?
It's faith. It goes into his relativity theory, and we don't have the time, or I don't think the expertise to go through it all. And what you need to do is go on faith. And that goes back to this equation. Have you faith? And they've proved these things. I mean, it's fascinating. That's where particle chambers come in. A lot of these stuff they've proven to be true. When you take a clock, and they've done this too, taking a clock, a cesium clock or something, put it in a spaceship, the mirror is going around up in space. And then they take a clock here on Earth, another cesium clock. When they bring them together, like Alfred and Brian and Charles over here, when they bring them together on Earth before they send them off, they're all clicking together. They're all the same time. When they send them up into space, what they find is they're different. Now, the reason for their difference there is they're not inertial frames. Gravity comes into the general theory of relativity. So what you end up with is gravity out there is different than the pull of gravity down here on Earth. So it's because of general theory of relativity, which gets into gravitational effects, acceleration effects, non-inertial reference frames, that cause the clocks to differ. And it'll be slower out in space than it will be for us.
So when it comes back,
You brought the clock back to Earth,
so you bring it back, mm-hmm.
The clock on Earth will be ahead of the clock out in space. And there's an interesting paper that I was reading by a gentleman named Humphreys, and it has to do with the Big Bang Theory and things like that. And he's a Christian. And what he's come up with is a proof using relativity theory that the Big Bang, if that's actually the way God did it, and it stays with the 1 day, the 6-7 days, that that can be explained through general relativity. Because what happens is, say there was a Big Bang, on Earth, a day could have gone by, but because of the velocities and the difference in gravitational pull of this stuff as it scatters out through space, that time frames for them, for that, would be different, which could explain for what we say is, you know, light, a galaxy is 1.2 light years away, or millions of light years away. And I haven't gone through all of his equations, but basically he's trying to reconcile, and he thinks he has, general relativity explaining the Big Bang theory and creationism and how it explains those distances if it happened in 6 or 7 days. And it really did. But then these are the two equations. One is the Newtonian one that we're used to, and the other one is the one that falls out of relativistic theory, and again, special relativity, not considering gravity, that explains the action of light. Or not of light, but objects approaching the speed of light. And as we saw from the one graph, you've got to be better than 3/4 of the speed of light before you really start seeing effects. Another way to look at these equations is to plot them. And basically what this plot does is it takes the first equation is a straight line. Whoops. It's a straight line because it's a linear equation. And the curved line is the Einsteinian equation for relativity. And if you look at a particle P traveling, and what you have is you have the ratio of u over c, which would be the reference frame over the speed of light, and the ratio of the particle over the speed of light. And as if you use the first one, the Newtonian one, it's a straight line, and you can go faster than the speed of light. It's additive. But if you use the Einstein's relativity one, what you see is that as you increase towards the speed of light, this would be the speed of light here, unity on both, it curves out. And the reality is it gets there. Well, it never gets there, or it becomes light. But there's other theories that tell us that matter can turn into light, but we don't know enough. Then there's Doppler shift. The Doppler equations we had before didn't include the velocity of light and this radical that you have in here. So when you start considering the Doppler shift on light, you do get, what happens with the Doppler shift on light is you end up with differences in the frequency. So you hear about red shift, blue shift. If it's moving to you instead of the pitch getting higher like you do with sound or pitch getting lower, you get red shift and blue shift, which means that the frequency, the wavelength of that light has changed. And that's what comes out of an equation like this. And thought I had a graph on that. Well, then something else that happens. We saw that time stops as you travel faster. Well, this chart here shows you going a quarter, a half, three quarter, then the speed of light, and this is length. If you're going in an inertial system, you're traveling in a straight line. So height won't change, but length will change. And the way the length changes, as you speed up, and you won't be aware of this. You won't be aware, if it's happening to you, that time's changing, that your length is changing. You're actually becoming skinnier. That'd be great. But you're actually becoming skinnier to an outside observer, and your clock is moving slower. To you, you don't know this. Unless you happen to hit the speed of light, then apparently you turn into light, and you'd notice that. But that's what this chart shows, the change. And again, things don't start happening until you get better than 3/4 the speed of light. And then you come to Einstein's E equals mc squared, which is really energy is equal to the change in mass times the speed of light. And the change in mass is its rest mass to the mass at a particular velocity. So you plug in this formula into here. And what you come up with, graphically, what you see, and I've got a chart here from a spreadsheet that gives us numbers. But graphically, what you see now is mass is the other thing that changes. So as you increase, again, the speed of light from a quarter to a half to 3/4 to the speed of light, and what will happen to your mass, and that's mass in pounds. Mass in pounds is wrong because pounds is a force, mass is slugs. But anyway, mass will increase to infinity. So that's not good. You get this way, but you get heavier, yes, because you turn mass into weight. So mass increases to infinity, time slows down and disappears, and distance in the direction you're moving shrinks. And what I did is I ran up a spreadsheet that shows relativistic effects on mass and energy. So I took rest mass and slugs, that's in a foot-pound system, and there's 32.2 pounds in the slug. Velocity of mass in miles per hour, velocity of light in miles per hour, and that's 670 million miles an hour. Increase in mass that you'd experience based upon the formula here that was on the other page. So forgetting about this part for now, what you see is if you increase your speed from 0 to 25,000 miles an hour, which is the rotation of the Earth, the speed of rotation of the Earth being at 25 million miles an hour, basically there's no change that's recorded. And you have to go out extended further decimal points. But as you get closer then, half the speed of light, 250 million miles an hour, you start seeing changes happening. You get up to 550 million miles an hour, you see changes definitely happening. Have you noticed if you get up in here, you don't see any dramatic changes until, forget about this line now, but this isn't change of frequency, this is change in mass. The dramatic changes happen when you start getting up in these speeds. You start getting up 667 million miles an hour, which is getting real close to 670 million miles an hour. So it's in that last, better than 3/4 of the speed of light that you see dramatic changes happening. And this becomes infinite because mass becomes infinite. It's undefined at that point in time. And that's what happens when the speed of the object becomes the speed of light. And this column here takes the E equals delta mc squared, and it shows you the power. You get a nuclear bomb, and you're just amazed by the power that's in there. It changes it. What is it in the English system? Is it joules? No. I forget what energy is in English. Horsepower, right? I don't remember. Anybody remember what energy is? Is it horsepower? Okay, this would be horsepower. The energy changes. If an object's at rest, no energy, because there's no change in energy potential in there. If you're moving at 10 miles an hour, that's 10 to the 4th. That's substantial. And then as you go out here, you're seeing it goes to 10 to the 24th. So it's dramatic. This is where they get the predicting of what a nuclear bomb can do. You can see the dramatic, just looking at the powers of 10 as you go up here. And then again, just as you get close to the speed of light, it starts going up dramatically again. Powers of 21, 23, 24, and then who knows. I'll tell you, it was fun putting this together. I kind of apologize for it because I hope there's some charts in here that you might be able to use, like the thought problems. I hope they were able to, you know, if you sit down and look at them, that you might be able to use them and some of the graphs that were in here to explain to people what happens as you move towards the speed of light. And it's just fascinating what you get into. When you look at, there's proofs in complex variables they came up with in 1968. A gentleman named Crenshaw came up with a proof using complex variables that an object can travel faster than the speed of light. So far, when we were at Fermilab, they had counters called Crenshaw counters on the beam line. And the object, I don't know what it did, but the objective was that if something was traveling faster than the speed of light, as predicted by Crenshaw, that it would detect it. Well, they haven't detected one yet. So either the apparatus is no good, the equation's no good, or, as Einstein said in his equations, nothing travels faster than light. Don't know. Anyway, I appreciate your patience. And if anybody has any questions, be glad to answer them now or get with you later. And if anybody wants these slides, be glad to give me your name and address and get a copy of them out to you.
Do you have questions? Yes.
I've heard over winter and again this summer that they found that the speed of light is decreasing. I was wondering if you've read that or heard that and how this affects what you're talking about.
If the speed of light were decreasing?
Yes.
That would blow us away.
Right.
Yeah, but completely annihilate what they turn into a principle. I have not heard that. Do you know where you heard that? Or
I was at a lecture this summer.
Okay. Yeah, if you remember, I'll give you my name and address. If you get a copy of it or who it was that gave them,
additional questions?
I read also that time is being shown. shorter, like our years are getting shorter. A lot of that is relative. As we get older, time. So many years as we keep increasing statistically, time gets shorter because our experience becomes that much longer. And so we live 40 years, and a year or 40 years is short. But to a child, when we were little, right, so like the days were forever. And summer vacation lasted forever. That's like 2 months of our life. That is long. But you're referring to the fact that time itself.
Well, I read it as I, you know, I'm not talking that. A century, each century progressively is some thousands of a second shorter than one.
Okay, that's because of entropy, variable entropy.
Yes.
That's because of entropy. What's happening is the Earth is slowing down.
It's not a real.
What they were talking about doesn't have to do with time itself. Time takes on. But that's why we adjust our clocks, we adjust our calendars. Because the Earth is wobbling, slowing down, and it is slowing down.
Okay, the other questions? Well, I think that I understand the principle of the theory of relativity, but the mechanical question I ask you has always troubled me. So you're saying that this has actually been done. They've put these clocks on a spacecraft, taken them back up. When you get them out, you look at, they don't synchronize anymore.
Right, that's why they call it the principle of relativity now, because mm-hmm. it takes Einstein's and Newton's, and they're no longer theories, they go to prove. And they also have done it on airplanes. They take them on airplanes, and they go on different directions around the world, come back, and compare the three clocks, and do it. That they relate to, that's what I don't understand. They relate that to special relativity.
Right.
But who knows? But the other one is definitely relativistic and general relativity.
So does something mechanically happen?
No. When you are traveling like that, you don't feel these things happening to you, which is really weird. It's like that happened. You don't feel the shrinkage of distance. You don't feel an increase in mass like that. And you don't feel the slowing down of time for you. Somebody else observes that, huh?
But maybe that clock was on that spaceship was running differently because of the lack of gravity and just more of a.
Well, that was it. It was the. Well, no, because we're talking atomic clock. And it wasn't because of gravity that they did four different. Exactly. General relativity brings in the concept of gravity. And that's what they proved by putting it on the station. So it was because of the effects of gravity, my eyesight didn't change.
So was it the speed factor or was it the gravity factor?
In that case, in that case what they're emphasizing was the gravity.
But it's not the gravity causing an increase of friction or a decrease.
I don't know if they put it on the meter. You can put it on the station or satellite above the Earth, and then the satellite's moving along with the Earth. The only difference there is the gravity. I'm not sure if it's on a meter because the meter is moving relative to the Earth. So there'd be another effect. Then again, they play with the equations and somehow cancel that out.
I'm particularly intrigued by this concept that relatively accounts for both the millions of years as well as the six-day creationism. That is an interesting.
If anybody's interested in that book, too, let me know. I'll get you the publisher, the author. I'm trying to ask what the Creation Science Group out of California now. You know who you are.
ICR, Institution of Creation Research. So they put the book out?
I think they did on the chart. I think he might not be affiliated with them because he believes in, he does not believe the water in the canopy yet. My bumper says, I don't believe, okay. Is that, I've got somebody posted on Morse and, what's his name?
Whitcomb.
Whitcomb, John Whitcomb. You may be right on that. I don't know for sure where he comes from. I think they just do that. Do that?
So is there some practical time machine that we can use to create more time for the WD tour or work?
You know, that's the question, because you'll go travel down. And even though you go into space and travel, you walk the distance, skis, and you come back here, and you come back, it might be, you know, top past 1,000 years or whatever, you come back, so you're going to be completely different. You don't live normal lifespan on that athlete speed. So you're, that's why I said, relative time to you doesn't change, but it does everything else. So it doesn't give you an advantage of what you're going to manage. So, I don't know if you want to do it. If you want to go back in 1,000 years in the future, you can get that close and see what happens.
Okay. Any other questions that you want to pop this direction? Well, I have one other question. So what are the possibilities that human beings will ever build something that is capable of hauling them around or speeding them up close to this speed and actually be riding in this piece of equipment?
That is exactly what people have heard about talking about. Because you've heard from pilot beams and plasma beams, mm-hmm. If you can take that particle accelerator and pack it so that you can shoot that beam out of the spaceship, remember the stuff, action reaction, the stuff going out the back is at the speed of light. So you would go the other direction at the speed of light.
Whoa.
So that's why people get excited. They were excited about it.
Really?
Back then, boy, you know, if we could take this capsule and find some way to generate this kind of energy, you know, in the volume we need to catapult the station, that we could, But anyway, if you catapult, if you polish it with a particle of silver, then you can run speed one. The problem is, it says creation, creation science is not correct. Who's published? I thought I had purchased this at the conference that was at. Masterworks. I thought I purchased this at a conference that was at.
Okay, there's a copy of the book.
So, who gave it to you?
Michael Peterson.
I'll leave it up over here. The front end of the book explains it in understandable terms, and in the back it gets into his papers that address about science.
Okay. If you have further questions, I'm sure that Ray would entertain them.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.